Hello, and welcome to Unlocking Games, a show about social impact games and how they provide a new way to explain the things you care about. I'm Brandon Carper, a training designer.
I'm Chad Hafley. I work in user experience and general web work.
And today we enter a new season of our podcast. As you might have noticed from the updated music, the updated name, even. Chad, are you excited?
Yeah, I have different facial hair now, but you probably can't tell. Everything is different.
May I point our listeners to our website to see before and after photos of your facial hair?
Oh, I'll see if I can do one of those nifty, like, sliding before after comparison things, sure.
I think that will add a lot to the world. Thank you.
I think it will, yeah.
So, on what I am calling Season 2 of our podcast, we are going to be focusing on social impact games. Games that explore social issues like elections, climate change, homelessness, immigration, and others. Our goal is not really to take a stance on those issues or to evaluate how accurate these games are, but rather to examine how effective their design is at achieving their goals. And we have a variety of lenses to look at this through. For example, we have the 20-some episodes of Season 1. Can you believe that, Chad? 20-some episodes.
For the low, low price of priceless.
Priceless or free, take your pick. Yeah. You can find the backlog on our website, unlockinggames.com, where you can learn about such things as Bloom's effective taxonomy, Nick Yee's Proteus effect. Chad, what were some of your more favorite theories that we talked about?
My favorite theories that we talked about. Well, there was the one where I just rambled on about how disappointed I was about No Man's Sky for a while. Maybe you can skip over that one.
Do you have a name for that theory, or is that
Chad's rule of don't pre-order games? I don't know. But no, I really like the procedural rhetoric stuff that we talked about in particular.
Oh, yeah. Very cool. So that brings us into an article that I got a lot out of recently called The Effect of a Persuasive Social Impact Game on Effective Learning and Attitude by Dana Ruggiero. And that article, it's speculated that games can be effective in the social impact realm by how immersive they are, by how much they use the principle of flow, so making things not too difficult, not too easy, and like Chad mentioned, procedural rhetoric, which is a concept that Ann Bogost explores very thoroughly in his work, and that's basically making an argument through the mechanics of a game.
Which I think is going to be core to a lot of what we talk about this season.
Yes, I think so. It's one of the things that makes me the most interested in looking at social impact games, because it's what makes them unique from other ways of persuading people and explaining things.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
We'll also be using some ideas from The Art of Game Design by Jesse Schell. I read that toward the end of 2016 and found it one of my best reads of the year. So Jesse Schell talks about games as experiences, and he provides 113 different lenses with which to examine games.
That's a significant number of lenses.
That is a large number of lenses. One of those is what he calls the elemental tetrad. Doesn't that sound exciting?
It does. That sounds very official.
Makes you want to place it next to other tetrads and make them disappear.
Oh, you stole my joke.
Ah, I beat you to it. So in the elemental tetrad, he talks about games having mechanics, aesthetics, story, and technology, and they all work together to create the game experience.
And that's one of the 113 lenses?
Just one.
All right, so in the next 112 episodes of this season...
we have our work cut out for us.
Yeah.
And speaking of story, one of the books that I found the most helpful for understanding how stories provoke an emotional reaction is Characters and Viewpoint by Orson Scott Card. That book is very dog-eared and worn in my library.
Is that not one of his fictional works, I assume? It's more about how to write or things like that?
Yeah, it's one of his books on writing. I've read a lot of books on how to write fiction, and this one really stands out for taking a real nuts and bolts specific approach to how you can make people care about your characters.
Nice. One of the other angles I think I'm going to be looking at things through is a concept I've run into recently at work called the Four Frames. It's from a book called Reframing Organizations by Lee Bolman and Terrence Steele. It's on its fifth or sixth edition at this point, so it's not a new concept. It's been around a little while. But essentially, it's what I think of as a better version of the Myers-Briggs kind of thinking, where you think about the frame from which people view their world, and then you can tailor your message to match that frame and hopefully convince them of something. The four main frames are structural, which is where people view the world as a machine. There's rules and an important structure to it. You can appeal to that. There's human resources, not the term I would have chosen for it, but since the book was about organizational work, I think it still kind of fits. From their perspective, at least. But if people who view the world from an HR frame would say the world is a family and we should care for each other and aim to empower each other, and that's their priority. There's the political frame. Think of this as political with a lowercase p, I think, which is hard. It's going to be hard to divorce from some of our talk this episode. But people view the world as a jungle, power is what is important, and it's all about competition for resources. And last but not least, the symbolic frame. This is the squishiest one, hardest to get your head around a little bit. The analogy of the world being something falls apart a little, but the closest that the world is a show or a performance, and so therefore things like stories, meaning, and culture are what's important, and appealing to values, purpose, and like a higher purpose and vision might work there. And one of their main points is that nobody uses just one of those frames, but most have a preference for one or two. So if you can identify where your audience is, you can tailor your message and hopefully reach them a little bit better. So, for example, if you're trying to reach people in the human resources frame, you would show the humanity involved in your issue. If it's a structural frame, show how current structures are or aren't working or what a new one might be, etc. There's a test you can take online. I'll link in the show notes to see which frames you might favor a little bit in your work. For full disclosure, I am more of a structural and HR framer. I don't know if that's the right adjective, than political or symbolic.
So you think the world is a machine, but also a family.
Yeah, it's a soft and loving machine. That works, well, right?
That's a slogan I can get behind.
Yeah. Tagline for season two.
Do you find that a lot of people in your workplace are kind of the same?
I think so. I see a lot of the HR frame in particular in the people that I work with. Our organization tends to value people very highly and does its best to empower them. You know, we run up against budget issues and other things that make that difficult, but that's one of the big things. If you like read the library strategic plan where I work, there's a lot of that in there.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I thought I was up to date on Myers-Briggs and the new... I don't know, what would you call these kind of tests? Personality tests? That doesn't seem like quite the right word.
Yeah, it doesn't give enough weight to it, but that's at the core, I think that's ultimately what it is. And that's why I think I never really like Myers-Briggs that much, as it feels like the equivalent of a Facebook quiz more than anything else. Whereas this is less about, like, there is a quiz to tell you what frames you might favor, but the point of the four frames is more about thinking where other people are positioned rather than where you are positioned.
Ah, I see. So an outward-facing view.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, without further ado, let's go on to a game. So a big social issue that is coming up tomorrow, January 20th, 2017, is the inauguration of America's president-elect. And leading...
Yep.
Leading up to this event, there were a lot of persuasive materials published. One of them was a game called the Voter Suppression Trail.
Which is anything you see the word trail attached to, you know the audience they're trying to appeal to right away.
Yes, they're trying to appeal to the audience who grew up playing Oregon Trail in the classroom to some degree.
Which is you and me.
Yeah, you and me. Personally, I played on, I believe it was an Apple IIe.
Was that the like green and black one?
Yeah, back when the colors were green and black. And is that the same version that you played, Chad?
I played a number over the years, but that's the one that pops up in my head when you do word association with Oregon Trail. Yeah.
Right. So the general, I guess, structure of Oregon Trail is you start the game and you pick a profession to be before you start out. I think there might be a carpenter or a banker.
The banker had the most money. Yeah, I remember that.
The banker had the most money, but the carpenter, I think, could fix your wagon if it broke down. And basically, then you just watch an ox pull your cart across the road, and occasionally you stop to do some hunting. I remember it was always a big deal when you got to a river if you were going to maybe pay someone to cross the river or try to ford it yourself.
Yeah, you could pay them to take you across on a raft, or you could try to, like, caulk the holes in your wagon and float it across. Yeah.
Right, right. And I don't think I ever actually got to the end of the Oregon Trail.
There's a valuable historic lesson there.
Yes. So, the Voter Suppression Trail was published in the New York Times on November 3rd, 2016, developed by a group called the GOP Arcade. They have a collection of politically themed games, including Trump's Pussy Grabber, EpiPen Tycoon, and Angry Olds. And a lot of these tend to mimic mechanics found in other games. For example, in Angry Olds, you launch old people at children in houses with pillars with names like Welfare and Renewable Energy.
It's really subtle.
Similar to Angry Birds. So, I know you might not be sure what the political leanings of this site are, but perhaps you can connect the dots.
Perhaps.
So, in the Voter Suppression Trail, you can choose to be one of three people going to a polling place. You can be a white programmer from California, a Latina nurse from Texas, and a black salesman from Wisconsin. And basically, you see that person standing in line, and it measures your frustration level and the minutes that you waited. And the goal is to make it all the way through the line and actually cast your vote. So the first person that I tried was the white programmer from California.
I think that was the last one I tried.
Actually. Oh, really?
Yeah. I figured I knew how that one would go.
And how did that one go, Chad?
He votes.
that's the rising climax and falling action.
He walks into the polling place and casts his vote. Hooray.
Yeah. I don't know if that was the one at the top of the list, but I feel like that would have been a nice... I guess, darkly comic beat to have at the end of the game. Because the other two folks have a much harder time. The Latina nurse from Texas encounters a long line because of, quote, GOP tactics that cut back on polling places and workers. And while she's waiting in line, she hears that her son has dysentery.
Womp womp.
Yeah, that's a reference to the Oregon Trail, where you would often die of dysentery and have a tombstone to memorialize that effect for.
Which was always kind of hilarious to think about until I actually looked up what dysentery is and realized what a horrible way it would be to go.
Yes. Yes. So, besides your son having dysentery, the voting machines can malfunction and delay the line. Your daughter might need to be picked up from daycare. And then by the time you finally finish waiting in line and actually get inside, there are, quote, election observers who try to intimidate you. And you have to escape their projectile insults as if you were an animal being hunted in Oregon Trail.
Which is not particularly difficult to do, at least for me.
No, that was pretty easy. And that gets you to the end of the game, where you have someone asking for photo ID, which you don't have. And you can either cast a provisional ballot or come back with the ID. If you try to cast a provisional ballot, the game shows a sinking paper boat, similar to what your wagon would look like in Oregon Trail if you tried and failed to ford the river. And then it shows you a gravestone and says your provisional ballot might not be counted.
I can't remember. Was the gravestone the grave of your ballot? Implying that you died because your vote was not counted.
I think it was the ballot. I don't think it went. Okay. I don't think it went as far as saying that you died because of your vote not being counted.
Yeah.
You do have the option to come back later, but if you do, the polling place has already closed, so you lose as well.
Mm-hmm. And that probably takes what, 5 minutes to play through?
Yeah, about a 5 minute playthrough. I was reading a making of article on Gamasutra.com, and I believe the creators intended to make the game a lot longer to make the frustration a lot more vivid.
Would this be the desert bus of election voting games? And it happens in real time.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's a lucrative niche, so I'm sure they're kicking themselves for not jumping at that chance. The other choice is the Black Salesman from Wisconsin, and this plays out significantly the same as the nurse. Your boss calls you and says you're late to work, docks your pay, cancels your next shifts, the machines malfunction again, a coworker needs you to cover for them. And at all these points, the game asks you if you want to leave the line to go take care of this or stay in line. And basically, if you leave the line, it's an instant game over. But if you stay in line, you become more and more frustrated. In this case, the freezing rain starts. There are also the same election observers with the same photo ID problem that you got as the nurse.
Yeah, they just swapped out a couple of graphics and it's identical otherwise.
Right, right. And then at the end of the game, you get a link to find your polling place, or you can play again as a different voter.
That was finding your polling place in real life, right?
Yeah, in real life. In real life. Mm-hmm. Which brings to mind the goals of the game. So I thought the game had kind of three apparently different goals it was trying to achieve. So the one, by showing you the link to your polling place, implies that the goal of the game is to get you to go out and vote. Right. Mm-hmm. But the game mechanics put you in the shoes of people in various ethnicities and life situations, which would kind of imply that the goal is to get you to be outraged by the plight of people who have to stand in line in the freezing rain and wait for hours to be able to get to vote.
Yeah, it's not a terribly subtle depiction of the problem.
Correct. And then for the third possible goal of the game, if you go onto the GOP Arcade website, that site says their games are, quote, designed to make all the hoopla surrounding the election slightly more enjoyable, unquote.
I'm trying to imagine myself discovering this game on, what, November 3rd, when it was released. I don't know that I would have felt relaxed.
You would not have felt slightly more enjoying of the election?
No, in retrospect, no.
So let's talk about what contributed to the success of any of these goals. So looking at the game from the aesthetic lens that we talked about with Jesse Schell, it appeals, like Chad and I said, to the people who played Oregon Trail in school. There's a lot of nostalgia that summons, I think, so it immediately engenders some goodwill.
I felt like it didn't capitalize on that goodwill.
Oh, really?
Personally, I thought that it felt like a coat of paint slapped over the top rather than I feel like there was more they could have done to make it more like Oregon Trail. You know, you're not really making any decisions that actually have an impact on gameplay, or there's only, what, two or three possible outcomes that you get, and it's very easy to end up in one of them. You don't really make any choices that matter at any point. Maybe that's part of the point they were trying to make. Like, it's all on rails. There's no flexibility in the way you approach the situation.
Yeah, that's very true. The only real choice you make in the game is who to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, you choose whether to leave line or not, but it's really the same choice presented over and over again.
Right. So what do you think they could have done to maybe make it a more engaging game experience?
I think more of what they did toward the end, where you have to dodge the insults from the election observers. I feel like if they had replicated more scenarios more closely to Oregon Trail in the way that that one did, it would have held my interest longer, or at least the novelty value would have lasted a little. On the other hand, it's only 5 minutes, so it's not like I could get that bored at any time playing through it. But I just thought they squandered a little bit of potential. It was a good concept that I felt like could have used some. Well, I would have liked to see that longer version you mentioned.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe if they had given you time as a resource to spend.
Oh, I like that.
And maybe every time someone calls you up to try to distract you, if you could spend from that resource so that there is a chance that you could take care of these other life things, but not immediately lose at voting.
Yeah, maybe you could manage to pick up one of your kids, but if you went for both, then you couldn't make it back in time.
Right. Make it a risk reward
scenario,
possibly. Mm-hmm. That might have been a slightly more engaging way to deal with the theme. Although the reversal of being an animal being hunted as opposed to a hunter from Oregon Trail, that was a nice touch.
Yeah, that's true. Although in Oregon Trail, couldn't you be mauled by a bear? Was that something that you could, or am I making that up?
I remember the version I played, I was never mauled by an animal.
Maybe I was just really bad at it.
The version I played, you just stood in one spot and you could rotate your guy and shoot your bullets that traveled at like 5 miles per hour, I think.
Okay, maybe I was paranoid.
And you would shoot the buffalo and there would always be more meat that you can carry back from the buffalo.
Yes, then you'd curse the world.
Right, exactly. And I would always ask, why can't I go back and get more meat? But I was missing mm-hmm. the point that we shouldn't kill buffalo.
Or bring the other people in your wagon who also have arms.
They have arms, but also dysentery.
Okay, maybe they shouldn't be near the food supplies anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point to bring up. I think one thing that was also effective was after every loss, you can see an explanation of that situation in the real world, which according to Gama Sutra was fact-checked by the New York Times. So every little storyline ended with some reference to how things are actually in America.
Was that fact-checking made apparent in the game itself? I can't remember.
Was it apparent in the game that they did the fact-checking?
Yeah.
I don't recall it being made apparent in the game. I think when I read the making of article, it talked about how since it was a New York Times op-ed, it was subject to the same fact checking that anything else published on the op-ed page would be.
Okay.
But yeah, playing the game, I don't think I would have necessarily made that connection or felt that authority behind the facts.
Yeah, which is maybe more about presentation by the New York Times rather than the game itself.
That's true.
And also looking at this through the frames, you know, the human resource frame, I thought one thing it did very well was get you to identify with the individual struggles of at least the two voters who had problems. And they seemed like people who have real life things that happen to them, and you could start to sympathize with even by those few minutes of gameplay.
Yeah, sure. They had problems that a lot of us can identify with, right? Like kids getting sick and bosses being on our back and so on.
Man's always keeping you down.
Man is always keeping you down. So I think in terms of things that might have been done differently, so we talked about some more game mechanics. I think also it would be interesting to look at the avatars that you get to choose. So we talked back in episode 21 about how assuming the avatar of a particular race might be more likely to activate some bad stereotypes about that race than to awaken feelings of empathy. So I wondered, what if the game had separated the avatar from the voting situation so that maybe you could pick both the race and the location? So maybe you could be a white programmer who lived in Texas and you had to stick to stand in that line, right?
That would be really interesting, actually. So you see the same, you know, baseline applied in different contexts and how that can differ.
Right, that might have isolated the theme of polling places being open and available, for example. Whereas as it is now, it's kind of tied, you know, specifically to race and socioeconomic status, which, you know, is probably the creators would argue a true statement, but might have, you know, distracted from the message that they're trying to get across to people who are like the white programmer who don't have to wait in line.
Or at the very least, I think having more than three options would have been interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
Especially for something that's so brief. I feel like I could have played through a half dozen of them very quickly and maybe gotten a broader impact of it.
Roguelike voter suppression
Yeah,
trend.
oh man. You can pick up the endorsement cards from the people who fell before you.
Yeah, exactly. And okay. Well, I'm not gonna go down that rabbit hole in the time we have left.
I'll file that in the games we could develop after these episodes.
Sounds good. The other thing that I wondered after I finished was so the game seemed to be primarily about making me feel empathy for those suffering from unfair polling practices, which you know, I think to some degree was certainly effective. But I wonder if it should have ended with a link to some petition or political action group about changing those practices instead of just asking me to go out and vote. That seemed kind of a vague, non-specific way to react to what I had just played through.
Yeah, so if you accept that a persuasive game like this should be built to apply to, say, all four of the frames that I mentioned earlier to reach the broadest possible audience, I said they did a pretty good job of getting to the human resources side of things. But I think in what you described, they missed the opportunities to do all of the other three. You know, they could have addressed the symbolic frame by, you know, appealing to a higher cause or to, you know, core values of, you know, America, Constitution, etc. There's the obvious political frame you could have attached it to, both capital P or small P of like, okay, so these people have problems voting, so what? Like, what does that mean as an impact? And there's possible to link there. And the clear thing that I really expected to pop up, even as I was playing through it, would be for the structural frame, bringing in like the Voting Rights Act, how it was not in full effect this election for the first time in since the 1960s, I believe, or somewhere in that area. Like, that's a clear structure that you could have mentioned and kind of educated about, and perhaps even pointed to people who are interested in that, able to do something about it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The game relies almost exclusively on making you feel bad for those people. But yeah, like you said, it doesn't really appeal to the larger institutions that are being affected by these people having a hard time voting, for example.
And especially for something that was billed as an op-ed, I think that was something I would have expected more, rather than, you know, you could argue that our if maybe the developer's goal was not to persuade people one or the other, but to put the facts out there and let them make their decision based on it. But then when you say it's an op-ed, all of a sudden I would expect these other factors to come into play.
Sure. Yeah, and I also wondered how the game would have affected me if I had been a Latina nurse from Texas or a black salesman from Wisconsin. As a white guy who, you know, full disclosure, I pretty much waltzed into my own polling place and voted
Mine was similar.
like the game portrayed. You know, I felt kind of bad and indignant for, you know, these other people. But if I had been in their shoes and that was my actual situation and I had played this game, I wonder if I would have been made more or less likely to vote. Or like,
Oh.
would I have played this game and thought, you know what? You know, I really don't want to put up with all of that at the polling place. I'm just going to stay home. You're right, game.
Why am I going to vote when my kid has dysentery anyway?
Right. But maybe, like you said, if the game had referenced, okay, because these people can't vote, this is what's going to happen to, you know, the country or, you know, our way of life as a nation. Maybe that might have, you know, provided them with a reason to go out and stand through the freezing rain to vote.
I should also probably point out that hindsight is 2020 at this point. And, you know, November 3rd, when this was made, I think the election was widely expected to go in a very different direction than it did.
That's true.
And that may have had an impact on how forceful the, as an op-ed, they thought it had to be toward getting people out to vote.
That's true. And I do think that, you know, that the game deserves some congratulation and recognition for making its way to the New York Times op-ed page at all.
Yeah. Is this the first game? Do you know of any others?
I don't know. It's the first one that I know of.
I was really surprised when I clicked on the link and saw it was a New York Times thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it opens the door for possibly more explorations through the use of some quick games. So if for nothing else, you know, I think that this game made great progress in that area.
Yeah, kind of a proof of concept that games could serve an op-ed role. At least, there may have been others where this is done before, but for me, it was the first I'd seen.
Sure. Well, speaking of the first, I think, Chad, we have reached the end of the first episode of our second season. You can join us again in 2 weeks as we move to our new once every 2 weeks format to learn about another election-related game, this one called The Migrant Trail.
We've done it. Only, what was it, 112, 111 now to go?
112.
Okay, so second season will be approximately 2 years.
Although, fair warning, the last lens is not called lens 113, it's called lens infinity.
What? No.
Oh, spoiler alert, sorry, for The Art of Game Design.
Isn't it like a 500-page book, too?
It is, but you know what? I really loved all of those 500 pages. Jesse Schell is not paying
I put it on my to-read list after seeing your endorsement, but then I saw it was 500 pages, and it may have slipped down the list a little bit.
Well, it's very cool. He talks about his experience designing attractions for Disney World, for example.
Okay, it's back up the list now.
Yeah, so it's very engaging, very, very conversational. I think you'd enjoy it, but this is not an infomercial for Jesse Schell's book. This is the outro for our episode. So, yeah, please go to our website, unlockinggames.com, to read a bit more about what we are talking about today, and, leave us a comment to let you know what you thought of our new show format. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at unlockinggames.
In particular, if you've got examples of games you think would be great for us to cover, we'd love to hear about them.
Yes, certainly. So, thanks again. I've been Brandon Carper.
And I've been Chad Haefeli.
Until next time, it's your move.